everyone, and welcome to another episode of Wisdom Chat Plus. And our subject today is bereavement. And I've got two wonderful guests. We've got Dave Moon from Full Circle, who's a funeral director. Hi there, Dave.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for inviting me, Phil.
That's okay. And Rob Brooks from Death and Disease. Hi there, Rob.
Hi, Phil. Good to see you.
And my wonderful co-host, Rachel Surtees. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Phil. As always, good to see you.
Thank you. And
I
likewise.
I just want to add a little correction. It's Dave Billington, not Dave Moon.
I
wasn't going to say anything because, you know, we're kind of interchangeable, me and the other Dave anyway. So yeah. To be honest, it works. I'm happy with it.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to own that. That was my mistake and I do apologise. But thank you, Dave, for your grace. Well, talking about, you know, who we are, Dave, would you like to just sort of introduce yourself and say a little bit about, you know, just who you are and what you do, and a little bit about Full Circle. And likewise, Rob, I'll come to you in a moment, if that's okay.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. So my name's Dave. So I'm our community impact lead. So I work for a company called Full Circle Funerals. So we're a small independent funeral directors that are based across Yorkshire. So we have a branch in Harrogate, one on the edge of Leeds in Bramley, our head office and kind of first place where we started is in Guiseley. And then we are soon to open in Ilkley as well, actually, in May this year. So as I said, we're an independent funeral directors and we help families at need to create funerals, but also help people towards end of life as well to plan for bereavement, which I'm sure we're going to come on to later in the conversation. So that could be things like funeral wishes as well as things like financial funeral plans.
Yeah. Thank you, Dave. I didn't realise how widespread you are as a company. All the best with the Ilkley branch. So,
thank you. Yeah, we started in 2016. And so prior to this, Sarah Jones is our founder. And prior to this, myself, Sarah, and our head of finance, Jade, all used to work together in a company that supported adults with learning disabilities. So me, Sarah, and Jade worked together for the best part of like 20 years probably now. And then when we first started the company, we wanted to create something that was much more, I suppose, holistic and was a bit more person-centered and kind of had elements of that health and social care kind of theme running throughout it.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful, Dave. Thank you very much. Rob, just come over to yourself, a bit about yourself and the work that you do and Death and Disease.
Yep. So the company is called Death and Disease. We help families and small businesses find insurance that pays out if somebody dies or has a horrible illness like cancer, heart attack, strokes, or is just off work sick. It's an area I've always found fascinating. We've been going just over 15 years because it's almost like solving a puzzle. There's this psychological element of it, but also the sort of puzzle of finding cover for people who are quite complicated. So some people are fit and healthy, but many people have all sorts of things that they live with, and they do brilliantly living with many ailments and illnesses, and finding insurance for people like that can be quite tricky. So that's something that we really specialise in. We deliberately call the company Death and Disease to help the conversation. When I first started, you know, every life insurance website was full of happy families, always dressed in white, flowing robes, dancing along a beach, looking as though they're having the best day of their life. Well, you know, if you've just been diagnosed with cancer or somebody's just died, that's not what you do. It's almost like they were afraid to look at the impact of death. They just wanted to sell the happiness. So we took a completely different approach. There was a few other companies have done something vaguely similar, but still life insurance companies are still full of laughing families. I just had a look before we came on. A couple of the two biggest insurers, they're still full of families looking like they're having the best day of their lives. So everyone does it differently.
It is difficult as well, isn't it, for many people talking about death and disease. So, I know we've talked before, but being very straight and down the line and not avoiding the issue, I suppose, is what the title of your business is, isn't it?
Well, it gives people permission to talk about death in a way, because it can be quite difficult. I mean, in Victorian times, death was everywhere. You know, if somebody died, they were laid out at home and everybody visited, two or three days. I think the Irish still do that, where you have a sort of wake in somebody's house. And it was it's very much you saw dead people. It was everywhere. Whereas now it's very hidden, and people aren't comfortable with death. I mean, I think people nearly always accept that they are going to die.
Yeah.
But they're just not. So, for example, I remember working in an office, and one of the people who worked there had lost a relative, and it was terribly sad. When they came back, everyone avoided them. You know, they said they're sort of, oh, I'm really sorry. And then, because they didn't know what to say, they weren't being unkind. They just were so uncomfortable around somebody who'd experienced grief and death. It's because I think in modern life, it's so sanitized and so separated from the realities of death. We don't come across it. I mean, lots of people have never seen a dead body, for example. So we need to give people permission to talk about dying.
Yeah,
thank you
for that.
That worked really well. Yeah,
and that just reminds me of when my father-in-law passed away. We were actually there in the home when he breathed his last, and I was thinking to myself, how do I handle this? And in a way, we tried to be just kind of matter of fact about it. But also at the same time, I'm just mindful of the fact that, you know, we don't want to skirt around the subject, because this is a part of, you know, it's part of our life's journey. It forms an important part of our life. So, yeah, thank you for that, Rob.
Absolutely. It's so death has absolutely become a sanitized subject, and in a relatively short space of time, as far as our society is concerned, I guess. And that then seems, from my perspective as a psychotherapist, to be leading to all sorts of kind of knock-on effects. So I'm wondering if you guys, David, could we start with you perhaps, if you're kind of seeing what some of the more negative repercussions about people not being able to kind of acknowledge death openly and speak about death, what they might be.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting subject, and I think everyone's had the best of intentions with death becoming quite, I suppose, to use the words that you guys have used, like sanitized or medicalized. And I think it's been there to sort of put safeguards into place to make sure that people's kind of end of life journeys are happening in the kind of best way possible. But I think bringing a lot of death into hospitals and hospices has removed it from our communities, as everyone's just kind of alluded to. And that has meant that the general kind of knowledge and, I suppose, conversation around the subject has just started to ebb away over the decades. Whereas I know when my gran was still alive, she used to talk about the fact that when somebody died on her street, everyone would go round to the house and they would all go and pay their respects. And naturally, conversations would then take place, because you were actually in front of somebody that had died, and you were talking about the memories associated with them. You'd be talking about what that process was like towards end of life, and people's knowledge would increase. Whereas I think now that that's started to sort of be removed, not from all, but from a lot of society, I think it is starting to sort of manifest in different ways for people. And so some of the families that we've supported through the years have reported things like their sleep being affected, sleep patterns, people not being able to sleep, or people feeling incredibly tired just all the time, even though they're getting a lot of sleep, kind of both ends of the spectrum. Sometimes it could be physical manifestations like aches and pains that they're not expecting, or it's affecting their memory. or just kind of general changes in mood. It seems to come all over the place. And that's just kind of, I suppose, the internal things. And then I suppose the knock on from that is, does it affect then your work productivity? As Rob kind of mentioned, people going back into work, how is that then affecting the relationships with people as they're then working with others? Because it's not a conversation topic that a lot of people are encouraged to talk about or don't really know where to start. So then it may damage their relationship with their peers, because someone that they thought that they were close to, maybe they don't know how to start that conversation, and then they come back into a place and that makes it really awkward for everyone. And then from a family perspective, if there isn't things in place like wills or maybe lasting power of attorney, if there's capacity issues for people that may be affected by things like dementia, then that can start to cause complications and sometimes fractures within relationships, within families as well. So there's all sorts of ramifications, but there, I suppose, are a few of the ones that come to mind when you ask that question.
Mm. What about you, Rob? Do you see any of those kind of like implications around people not wanting to talk about serious illness and death and so on? Do you see that impacting in your work, line of work as well? People's like decision-making processes, ability to actually come forward and seek out services, that sort of thing?
It's fascinating, actually. I mean, the conversations we have, possibly, I don't know if it's different from you, Dave, but we have them with generally reasonably healthy people who aren't expecting to pass away anytime soon. Our experience is that people mostly will talk about death. It's really just something that doesn't feature in their lives. That's all. It's not on their list because they're most of our customers being sort of 30 and 60, and it's just not something they think about. It's not that they don't believe they're going to die. It's just not on their radar at all. But talking about death is generally not something that they struggle with. Obviously, with a name like death and disease, it opens up the conversation. The thing we find that people find much more difficult, much more fearful of, is a protracted illness. The idea of just sort of going to sleep, not waking up, they can cope with that, but the idea of a horrible, painful, long, dreadful illness, they find very difficult to even contemplate. Mm. But for example, sometimes at networking events and things like this, I was talking about death not being on people's radars. I'll say, well, I'm 50 years old, which I am, and I'm going to die when I'm 80. And people are like, you can't say that. Well, but it's very likely, isn't it? That's about the life expectancy. And that's 1,560 weeks away, literally. And people have never thought of life like that. And the ramifications of that are that they just sort of, they don't get on with the life. They don't do the things they want to do because they just sort of think that death's going to be, their life's not infinite, but it seems so far away. And when people actually think of it like that, they often actually grasp life and think, what do I want to do? It's interesting. There's a surprising number of people get divorced when they're diagnosed with serious cancer, because it wakes up and they think, I might not have much time left. Mm. I'm going to get on with it. And this person, they're okay, but I don't really want to be with them for the rest of my life. And it's surprising how they'd never thought of that before. So there's lots of ramifications for death and just not being on people's radar.
Mm, it's almost as if people, it's a phenomenon that I come across, that's not going to happen to me. So everybody knows, yeah, it's the probably the one and only certainty in life is that we're born and we die. Everybody knows that rationally, cognitively, they can kind of think about it academically. But it's almost like people behave as if it's the thing that's not going to happen to me. That doesn't apply to me when it comes to decision-making processes.
I'm just thinking about my experience with my delegates who attend my courses, because one of the things that we do talk about are things like wills, lasting powers of attorney. And the thing that really strikes me is the fact that there's so many people don't have a will and don't even know what a lasting power of attorney is. So they've not explored these things. It's almost as if, that's way off. I remember you know, as a teenager, just starting my working life, somebody talking about pensions and thinking then, oh, that's way off. I don't need to think about that. And I just wonder if oftentimes people approach it in that way, that that's a long-term thing. I don't need to think about it now. But it is, when you explain this to people about the importance of a will and what this will do for you should something happen, and what lasting powers of attorney will do for you should a situation arise where you would need to use that, all of a sudden they start to think, oh, I better have a look at this then, hadn't I? So it kind of...
Well, it depends. So you're right. Yeah. You know, so we have conversations with people about wills and lasting powers of attorney every day, and people generally fall into two or three camps. Some people will talk about it very, very matter of fact. In fact, it's almost a relief to talk about it. Mm. And other people, it's just not in their head. They just can't face that this is going to happen. It's just not something that they can really. I mean, I remember going around to see a couple, and we were going to talk about wills. And the husband, when I walked in the door, he ran up the stairs and ran away because he was so uncomfortable about the thought of, which, you know, I felt for him. I didn't want to cause that sort of distress. But and I don't know what that was all about. And there may be many things going on in his life. But some people find it very difficult. But the other thing is, even when people have written a will, is they need to talk to whoever their family about it, because there are so many family feuds caused by wills and inheritance. It's horrible. And no, I've never met anyone who wants to cause problems for their children. And yet children, all the issues from childhood, you know, you stole my chocolate bar age 3 or whatever, come out when the parent dies. And by sitting down and talking to their children about death, about funerals, about wills and et cetera, while you're alive, does help. Doesn't necessarily make it perfect.
Yeah,
that does help. I mean, you must have this experience, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo that. I think a lot of the families that have come to us, because we, I suppose, project ourselves as a bit of a funeral director that can be a little bit more holistic, and I suppose we're a little bit different than some other funeral directors out there. We do have quite a lot of creative families that come to us that want something a little bit different. And sometimes they will come to us ahead of time. So they do something like a financial funeral plan. So they'll kind of get all of the money side of it squared away. And then other times that's not so much of a priority. It's more about the emotional side of it. And really, as you said, Rob, like engaging with their family about the subject. And so a lot of the times we do something called funeral wishes with families. And so this is just a simple document that there's loads of versions on the internet. We've got a free version on our website if anyone's interested, but essentially it's just a collection of questions, and it just gets people thinking about the subject of what you would want for your funeral. But not just that, also thinking about some of the more practical things of how you would want your own body to be cared for. Who do you want to be caring for your body? Do you want it to be family members? Do you want it to be funeral professionals? What gender do you want those people to be? Going into details of how to encourage other people to actually engage in the funeral process. So it might be things like if you want to get a cardboard coffin, for instance, and be a little bit more friendly to the environment, this could also double as a bit of an artistic space for family members and friends to come and express themselves on the receptacle that's going to be holding you for either your burial or cremation. And we've had multiple families through the years where we've delivered coffins to their houses, and they've kept it for sort of a week, a couple of days, and people have come round either at different times or all on one event, and they get drinks and food, and they essentially share stories of the person. We've even had people do this ahead of time as well, before they've died, and then stored it themselves. But it just creates this opportunity for other people to kind of start that conversation and feel like they're actually engaged in the process, because a lot of the, I suppose, feedback that we've had through the year when we've done various research projects. Because, as I said, we don't come from a funeral director's background. We wanted to do some research into what the public's view was on funerals and what people constituted as a good funeral. One of the bits of feedback was that a lot of people felt disengaged from the process because they were essentially just turning up to something that they had no input in whatsoever. So the more opportunity that people can have where they feel like, actually, I'm a part of this in some way, I think can be really helpful for people's grieving processes. And as we've been discussing, just to kind of start off that conversation and make it something that's a bit more approachable.
I think what we're kind of like skirting around or like dipping ever so slightly into is the area of like death positive conversation or death and disease positive conversation. And I mean, again, I use my own experience as a psychotherapist. I have had conversations with both my children about what my funeral wishes are already. We don't skirt around difficult conversations in my household. It's one of the things I'm quite well known for, which is a bit of a running joke, really. I find it quite amusing anyway. I'm not sure everybody else does. But when I've sat down and gone, like, both my parents have died, and I've spoken to my kids and gone, just for the record, I don't want any of this nonsense that's happened like for my parents when they have died. This is what I want at my funeral. This is how I want it to go. You know, they've been squeamish about it and really kind of like intolerant of it. So even though difficult conversations are not unusual in my household, there is something that they have learned from me or society or something that tells them, we don't want to talk about death. That's a thing that we don't want to go near to. So I'm curious about how you guys encourage positive conversation about death and illness, serious illness.
We'll just go straight in it. We don't skirt. We don't sort of, you know, touch on it very gently and pretend, you know, use long words to try and hide it or any jargon. No, it's straight in, you know. What would you do if you got cancer? And you can see people flinch, which is difficult, but if they don't feel emotionally what it might be like if that happened to them, they often don't do anything. And there is about 5 or 6 times a year, I get a phone call from people that we've been to see. They decide not to do any insurance, fine, fair, no problem. We're very gentle, we're not some sort of hard sell. And then they phone up a few years later and say, I've been diagnosed with X. And that is such a horrible, horrible feeling, because you always think, goodness me, should I have been a bit more, you know, did I do the right thing, etc. That we find that just being very direct is definitely the best way. And people generally are fine with it. It can be difficult if they have they're experiencing grief, or they've had a relative who's been affected by a serious illness. So that can be difficult. I mean, I'll be interested in days you are. Personally, I don't think grief ever goes away. It's such a powerful, possibly the most powerful emotion. And possibly that's why, you know, your children, Rachel, don't find it easy, because the thought of grief is so strong and so horrible that it is something that's very difficult to cope with.
Well, in psychotherapy theory, or at least in one of the theories around grief, that every time we touch into grief, all of our griefs that we have experienced in our life, be that the bereavement of a loved one, the loss of a relationship, the loss of a business, the loss of a way of life, all of our griefs come to the surface. So it, like you say, it's okay. A powerful, intense feeling that arises in us when we start to face into grief, even if that's just a conversation. Is that something that you experience as well, Dave?
Well, I've got to say, just in terms of the sort of initial question, I think it really depends on who we're talking to as to how we personally respond. So we come into contact with people that are in very different situations. So sometimes it might be someone that's on an end of life pathway, and really wants to sort of put everything in place because they know that they're in their final year to months of life, and they want to get things in place to support not their own just kind of mental health and well-being around that, but also all of their family and friends. Other times it might be people that are completely healthy and are just putting something in place for the future, or want to kind of start off that conversation. And I think that's a very different approach, but has the same kind of end goal, that we want to essentially prepare people and improve their sort of death literacy, I suppose, so they feel more confident in their knowledge around the subject and able to make choices that are going to best suit them and everyone that loves them. But some of the community work that we do, I suppose, is a little bit more less direct and more gentle. And it's more about kind of opening up the conversation in a place where people might feel easier, that it's an easier pathway to starting it. And so an example of that is a project that we've been running for about 2.5 years now called the Art After Loss Project. And this is an online digital gallery that was originally kind of started by one of our team, because she is a very artistic person and she'd created a series of paintings all about her feelings around her mum's death. And that then inspired us to think, well, hang on a minute, if she's doing this, I wonder if there's other people that would benefit from doing something creative as this kind of therapeutic method for expressing themselves. And so we started to put the word out, and over the years, we've now gathered a whole, well, gallery of artwork, from short films to illustrations to paintings to sculptures, music, absolutely every medium that you can think of. And we've been putting on physical exhibitions in various different places around Yorkshire to encourage people to kind of think about, actually, is this something that would be helpful for me? And sometimes there've been pop-up exhibitions in cafes. We've had them in a few different places around Harrogate. We had one in Hebden Bridge Town Hall. We've got one in Ripon Cathedral in February next year. And we've got a couple going on throughout West Leeds during Dying Matters Week, which is a national awareness week, which this year is between the 8th and the 14th of May. And this type of kind of in the background sort of work, where it's not really shouting about it, but it's more like you'll walk into a space that you're very familiar with. So a cafe, you might go to a coffee and cake, and then you see a piece of artwork on the wall and think, okay, that's quite nice, but it doesn't scream bereavement. But then when you read the context card, that then makes you think or start a conversation about something which is important to you. And I think every approach in this area has its pluses and minuses, because not every approach is going to be perfect for every single person. So I think we need to have lots of different styles to appeal to different personalities. And then just to touch on the kind of support that's out there, there is a lot of people where grief is something that it's an ongoing process. It's not something that's ever going to disappear. And so for some people, an immediate support is needed, because they might have been through something really traumatic, like a murder, or someone's taken their own life, or someone might have died in a road traffic accident, or it could be an illness that's taken someone's life really quickly and just no one was expecting it because they were diagnosed extremely late and didn't have symptoms until, in some cases, the sort of last month or weeks before they're at their end of their life. And that can be really difficult for a lot of people. And so in those cases, there are kind of signposting to counselling sessions, to various sort of therapy services and national charities that we can do. But as a more kind of ongoing support tool that we use for our community, our lovely team member Ruth has been running a free bereavement support group for about 4 years now. It meets through Zoom. And it's essentially just a collection of people across Yorkshire that are all bereaved, and they just want to talk to other people that are in a similar sort of circumstance and just have a conversation with somebody that's happy to talk about the subject. Because as we've talked about quite a lot today, not a lot of people are. And a lot of people are just kind of screaming out to just have a chat with somebody that can just get on their wavelength. And so it's not a counselling session by any sorts, but it is somewhere where people can kind of speak freely and openly and hopefully find someone that they can get a little bit of a connection with on that subject.
For both of you, perhaps more so Dave, do you ever come across people who as adults they've never been able to, as children, talk about the grief they felt for, say, a parent. And I'm thinking about my own experience. When I was 10 years old, my father passed away. And in those days, it was almost like children are seen and not heard. And we were farmed off to some, you know, family friend to take us off for the day while the funeral was going on. And nobody ever spoke to us about it. And it's only years later when I understand a lot more about psychology and, you know, the emotional side, that I started to realize I'm actually carrying, that had been carrying, grief from childhood that nobody ever gave me the chance to talk about. Do you come across that at all in families?
Rob, do you want to take this one?
To be honest, we don't particularly come across that. I mean, one of the questions that we ask people when they're taking out insurance is about their family history. And sometimes that can be, some people very, find that people, for example, who have experienced cancer themselves will talk about it all day long without any difficulty at all. Often their friends and relatives find it very difficult to talk about, but they themselves find it very easy. But and are usually quite glad to talk about it. Though everyone is different. Some people are just sick of the whole subject and they just want to talk about anything but their own illness. But in terms of families, we ask about family history, and that can be difficult for people. But it just depends on the people. But that's as close as we really get to it, to be honest, Phil.
Yeah,
but yourself, from our perspective, Phil. Yeah. Yes, yeah. It does come up, and it really depends upon the family that we're talking to, because sometimes people want a very professional relationship with us that's almost business-like, and other times the rapport gets much deeper than that, and they entrust us with lots of personal information and essentially kind of give us a bit of an insight into their life. But in all circumstances, what we try to do is just offer a service that's going to be as kind of flexible to their needs as we possibly can, and just open up a way of kind of helping them create something which is going to be meaningful. And so if this type of subject comes up, sometimes what we'll explore with them, if there's children that are involved in the kind of wider network of that death, is ways of engaging with the younger people. Because for some families, it might be that actually they don't feel that it's appropriate that children are involved in the funeral. And for other people, they really want to, but they're not really sure where to start, because they might not have experienced it as children, as you've just alluded to. And so sometimes it could be as simple as something like a grandchild maybe writing a letter to their grandparent or to their parent and putting that into the coffin. Sometimes it might be part of the visiting process where they come and actually spend time with someone that's died, with either on their own or with an adult, depending on the age of the younger person. For very, very young people, so we're kind of talking babies or even toddlers that maybe not, they might not have the memories later on in life of what the funeral is like, say if their parent has died or someone really important in their life. Sometimes we talk about actually having that recorded. So is there a way in which that a photographer could come or a videographer and they make some sort of physical recording of that event, so then they can look back on it further on in life? Because at that point, they're probably not going to have any memories. And other times it might be something around, we work on with a theory that kind of underpins everything we do called continuing bond theory. And this is the idea that after somebody dies, it's about keeping that connection alive, essentially, and finding ways to be able to connect with the person that's died, even after their physical body has left this plane. And so a simple way of kind of doing this would be, let's say the person that's died used to go to Toast in Ilkley, giving them a shout out, for a coffee every single Tuesday. Absolutely loved the place. And every time you go to that place, you can think, while you're having a coffee, I'm going to think of memories of that person. And that's just an instant connection. It's a very easy one to do. But maybe a more physical activity that's associated with children is their grandma might have had a really favourite walk on Ilkley Moor. And on that walk, you can go all as a family and you can collect some stones as you're going along. And then when you get back, you can get a jar and get your stones, and you can think about positive memories to do with that person and make a marking on that stone to represent that memory. So it could be painting the stone in a certain color. And every time you put a stone in the jar, that represents a positive memory of that person. So eventually you've got a physical object of memories, essentially. And it's that every time you look at it, every time you touch it, you can think, oh, this represents my grandma and this specific memory.
Yeah, that's a really great idea, is that. I just had a side thought, though. I wonder if anybody's had jars that are virtually empty. You know, you're thinking, no, it's, I know we're talking about a very, challenging subject for many people, but you're right. Being able to talk about it, and for me, when I was younger and not being able to talk about it, I wasn't able, even as a 10-year-old, to really process what we're experiencing. And yet it impacted both myself and my sister at the time. And one of the things that really struck me was, over the years, I can see how that impact has actually manifested itself in life and behaviour and attitudes and so on, because we've never been able to process it. But the moment that you are then able to process it and start to work through it, it's actually quite cathartic, and quite liberating as well.
I think, Phil, people are also quite fascinated by death. We do LinkedIn posts about different diseases, disease of the week, and we have passing posts about unusual, interesting deaths. And we get lots of engagement. People are fascinated by death. It is a taboo subject. It's just something that is just doesn't come up in conversation. They're not really sure how to have the conversation about it. But they actually, in our experience, people are usually fine having a conversation about death.
I think in my experience, if you offer ostensibly a safe space, i.e. a place where you're going to talk openly about it, you're going to make it clear that you're going to talk openly about it, people will step into that space. And what I tend to see is a sense of relief. People go, oh, we can talk about this stuff that we're not allowed to talk about anywhere else. And they come in and they engage with it, often in quite an excited and curious kind of way. In my experience, it's not always the case.
That's interesting, actually, Rachel. Yeah, because
most of the time it is.
That's, I guess, when a business owner invites us in to talk to them about what would happen to their business if they died, they're expecting to have that conversation. I'm sure you'll have a similar experience. It's expected. It's not completely out of the blue, and therefore that's, you thought of it now. It's a safe space that has been created, isn't it? And so. Mm-hmm. And people are, it's very, very rare we come across people who can't talk about it. I don't know what your experience is, Dave.
It's very mixed, because it really depends on the people involved and what their life experiences have been like. Generally, I would agree and say that most of the time when we are talking to people, I think they have mentally prepared themselves for that conversation. But sometimes it's more welcomed than others, because if it is something that's been very sudden, some people, they really don't want to engage in the conversation, but they're forced to, essentially, by the culture, because there's a cultural expectation within Western world, really, that funerals happen within this kind of 2 to 3 magic week window. Someone dies and then you have to have your funeral within this window, otherwise I'm not sure why it's been pushed like this, but it seems to be expected that happens. So one of the things that we normally do is, when we kind of start off our conversations, we make it really clear that actually that window doesn't exist. And you can take as long or do things as fast as you want to. And so in some cases, when we've supported families, but mainly for religious reasons, we've had a funeral happen within 24 hours. Of the date of the death. And then the opposite end of that spectrum is that we've had one family where it was a number of months that we cared for the person that had died, and we just gave them a lot of time to be able to consider the options and kind of process the information that we'd been talking about, because it was really clear that they didn't want to rush this, and you really don't have to. So I find it very interesting to kind of see what everyone's reactions are once you kind of open up the subject matter of you don't need to rush this conversation. It doesn't need to be something that you make all the decisions in straight away.
Yeah.
And that, as we're just starting to kind of wind up, I guess, because we're coming to the end of our time together, I'm curious about, I think people can feel a lot of shame about not doing things on a time scale. So there's a bit of me wants to put a little bit of normalization in there. If you've had a shocking experience of somebody who's very important in your life suddenly disappearing off the face of the earth, your nervous system is going to be shot, and your cognitive function is going to be shot as a result of it. So rational conversation, decision making, all of those things that I guess society as a whole expect us to do, like you said, that window doesn't actually really exist, but society seems to perpetuate the idea that it does. It's not necessarily possible for people to do that. It's not just that people are unwilling to engage, they're not capable of engaging.
It's interesting, actually, in very briefly, in terms of claims, you know, I've been phoned up many, many times from people who would say, you know, my wife died today. And it's just they want to do the administration of death because it helps them cope. It's almost it's a way of it's sort of, you know, the ticking boxes just as something to keep them like a handrail. And other people, that you know, they ring you a year later. So people cope with it in completely different ways, definitely.
Yeah. I just thinking about something that I think, Dave, you alluded to earlier on, and I think, Rob, you mentioned it as well, was the fact that how people respond outside of the person who or people who are experiencing the bereavement, how other people may respond. And it just reminded me of an occasion where a couple were late back. I was living with them at the time, and when they arrived, the first thing that the lady said was, my father's died unexpectedly. And my first thought was, wow, how do I deal with that? What do I say right now? So the only thing I could think of at the time was, I'm really sorry to hear that. I don't know what to say to you, but please accept my condolences. And what really struck me was the fact that this person said, it doesn't matter that you don't know what to say. It's just the fact that you've said something is really helpful. And I think you both alluded to it very early on about the fact that people don't, because they don't know what to say, they don't want to say the wrong thing, so they avoid it. And that sometimes is more hurtful for a person who's going through grief and bereavement to have people who they thought were close friends or colleagues actually pull away from them, but they're pulling away because they don't know what to say and they don't want to say the wrong thing. So what would your advice be to those people if they found themselves in a situation where somebody had just experienced bereavement?
Obviously the first thing we say is how sorry we are. And then we'll ask them if it's something they want to talk about or how do they want us to engage with it? Because some people do want to talk about it. Other people, they really, really don't. So we just ask them. So and then we can tailor how we are to exactly what they need.
Yeah. Yourself, Dave?
Yeah, I would echo that. I'd ask, not kind of how are you doing? Because that's a bit too broad. And I would focus it a little bit more and say, thank you for sharing that. I wouldn't offer my apologies because in some cases you don't know the person and it might come off as a little bit ungenuine, but I would say, thank you for sharing that. How are you feeling today? And make it really, really specific to this moment. And then if you get a response where you feel like they want to engage and you want to continue that conversation, ask about the person that has died. Say, would you like to talk a little bit about Sam or whatever the person's name is? Because it might be that they just want to share some memories of that person, and actually giving them the opportunity to start to talk about that person might be really helpful, because I think a lot of the time people are scared to say the wrong thing, but sometimes people just want to talk about memories of that person that they really, really enjoy. And you might have a shared memory with that person if you know them, and it might be really, really helpful to them to actually share your memories of that person and start to engage with them rather than kind of just offer a platitude and then the conversation ends because you don't know where to take it.
Totally. And also, you can't assume actually that the person is sad. I've had conversations with people and they've said, oh, my mum died. And I've said, oh, you know, I'm really sorry to hear that. And they said, no, I'm really pleased, because they've been living with dementia, for example. Their mother had been really, really upset, and it had been really difficult for everybody. And it was a release. And she was, obviously she was sad to lose her mother, but she'd been had dementia for years, and she saw it as a positive. So you can't assume someone is necessarily distraught. She'd already done her grieving when her mother, lost her capacity. So you can't assume anything.
And on a similar lines, again, not assuming, you can't assume that if somebody's lost somebody and they are being impacted by it, that they are necessarily upset to have lost the person, because you don't know the nature of the relationship that they have with that person either.
Very true.
I have personally experienced a loss where people have gone, I'm so sorry to hear that. And I've gone, why? You know, why on earth would you be sorry about me losing that person in my life? There's challenges that I'm facing around that, and I've got things that I need to come to terms with, and it's helpful if I can talk about that stuff, but please don't be sorry for me, because I'm not sad to lose them. So you know, you can never know what somebody's experience is going to be in advance. So what you said, Rob, about asking, my gosh, that's significant news. What does that mean for you?
That's a really good point. And I suppose on that note, time has passed us by. And I'd like to say thank you to Dave and to Rob for being our guests today and talking, I suppose, for many about a difficult subject, but actually from the point of view that we do need to talk about these things. We do need to be open about these things and not be afraid to talk about them. And if we do struggle talking about them, maybe something else is going on that it would be good to just ask for help. There's nothing wrong in asking for help, and there's nothing in asking for help that says, well, that's weakness. At the end of the day, I believe it shows strength of character, the fact that you can actually admit, this is an area I struggle with, can you help me with it? So guys, thank you so much for coming and sharing with us like you have done. And if somebody wants to connect with you or, go onto your website, how can they get hold of you? Dave, how could they get hold of you or get hold of Full Circle?
Well, pretty easy to find. If you just type in Full Circle Funerals, we will pop up. So as I said, we've got a place opening in Ilkley in May. We already have active locations in Guiseley, Bramley and Harrogate. And if someone wants to get in contact with me specifically, probably the best way to do it is through email. And my email is just david@fullcirclefunerals.co.uk.
Thank you very much. And Rob, yourself as well.
Yeah, very simple. Just type www.deathanddisease.com into the internet. You can also search for death and disease on LinkedIn. And my personal email is rob@deathanddisease.com.
Thank you very much, Rob. And I love the way you emphasize that, just driving that point home there. It's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you, Rachel, for being a fantastic co-host, and all the best, guys, going forward.
Thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
Take care.